So this is preaching the resurrection appearances of the Gospel of John, although it's more about the resurrection appearances than it is about preaching them, I think. But I'd welcome any thoughts as we go along. So let me, you have an outline. There is a brief outline of what I'm going to do. Talk about the two sets of resurrection appearances in John 20 and John 21. And muse on them a little bit and why I suppose I find them particularly compelling. There are different, of course, resurrection stories in all the Gospels, and John's have some distinctive stories, some of my favorites. But I want to just talk a little bit about the two groups first, the ones in John 20 and John 21, and how what I think they're each doing and how they are in some ways different. You know that the chapter divisions are arbitrary. That is to say, John did not say, oh, I'll write some appearances in chapter 20. Now I'll put some in 21. But it actually is a way to remember how they do fall out. And at the end of chapter 20, there is this summary statement. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. These are written that you might believe. And it looks like the gospel ought to end. That's it. Why do we need more? And so chapter 21 has always puzzled people. What's it doing here? And in fact, a number of folks think that it is some kind of addition added at a later point, especially since it talks about the first appearance as the third one Jesus made, when in fact it isn't number three, it's number four or so. So there are a number of oddities about it. But let me just distinguish the two sets of resurrection appearances in this way. One way to talk about the themes of the resurrection appearances in John 20 is that they establish the fact that Jesus is alive. He's been dead, so it's, you know, all the sort of surprise stories we have. Whoa, we saw Jesus. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. You know, that sort of amazing thing. So there is the statements just that Jesus is living. I think they go a ways, this is not exclusive to John 20, but towards establishing the personal relationships that were broken by his death, especially with Mary, but with the other disciples as well. And then the third thing is that they provide for us a witness to the one who both lives and has life in himself. Now, this is one of my sort of favorite and key verses in the Gospel of John that I think tells us a lot about the person of Jesus, who he is, why he does the things he does, and so on. And it comes in John 5, verse 26, for as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. That even as God has no source, no origin, Jesus himself has life as the Father has given it to him. Now that's a conundrum, because he either does have life in himself or he doesn't have life in himself. But he has it in John, because the Father has given it to him. And so there's a lot of interesting Christological speculation, of course, that has come out of this verse. But it's important that he is this living one. According to the beginning of the gospel, in him was life. The life was the light of all people. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. If he's dead in a tomb, what happens to that identity, that promise? So to establish the fact that he is indeed living seems to me to be part of the resurrection appearances in John 20. Notice, though, that the way this is established is primarily through the witness of others. Other people tell us we saw him. Other people tell the disciples he is alive. So I'm going to come back to that theme because I think it's important. But if you can just group the resurrection appearances of John 20 under the heading Jesus lives, it'll be enough for now. I'm going to look at each of these in a little bit more detail, but let's just go with that for John 20. So then you have a statement of purpose, and now you have three more appearances, and they come at a later time. Remember, the ones in John 20 are all on Easter Sunday night, and then a week later. So they're pretty closely grouped, and we don't really know when the ones in 21 happen. Is it supposed to be 2 weeks later, a year later? You know, it just doesn't say. But the point is, it really doesn't seem important now to establish again the point that Jesus is living. So what are they doing in the gospel? And I've got three things here that I think, under the general heading, Jesus' life-giving and life-staining work continue. many ways, this is picking up on the theme that Scott preached on this morning, if you were in that service of the word, that Jesus' life-giving work goes on, his sustaining, he's always there. This continues even after the resurrection, which has changed everything. But we will see in this period, if Jesus' life-giving work goes on, then it needs the witness of others to Jesus to say to people that this is so, because Jesus is not here, and that witness is not palpably seen in the way it was when he was flesh on earth. So in order to for anyone to know that, it will take the witness of others. Witness is one of the most important themes in John, I think, that sometimes gets overlooked. A second thing that these appearances in chapter 21 stress is Jesus' ongoing presence with and provision for his disciples. He's still providing, he's still feeding, even as he had. And that for me underlines what I'm going to talk about, one of the most important themes for me in the resurrection appearances. And then there'll be an emphasis on the particular role for Peter as shepherd of the sheep. If Jesus' life-giving and life-sustaining work continues, what does that look like? And this is where Peter and the beloved disciple, the disciple whom Jesus loved, figure in, but especially Peter. So you have both the establishing of the reality of Jesus living, Jesus' life, and then a statement about the continuing of his life-giving work. So let me, maybe another way to say it is that Jesus, I might put it this way, in spite of the fact that it seems that Jesus is gone, and absence is a big problem in the Gospel of John. Where are you going? Why can't we go? I'm going away. Don't worry, I'll come back. You know, it gets a lot of play in the so-called farewell discourses. He's going away. Everything will change. And so somehow chapter 21 says, 20 says, yes, but, 20 and 21 together, yes, but he is still present. How can this be? Because he is alive and because he still gives his ongoing presence gifts even so. So let me just talk through each of the appearances with you in a little bit of detail, and then we'll try and do some summary and talk together about preaching them. The first one is one of the strange stories in the Gospel of John. The story, this is in chapter 20, verses 1 through 10. And this is the story of when Peter and the one we call the beloved disciple, the disciple whom Jesus loved, who's never actually named in the Gospel, have a foot race to the tomb on Easter morning. Now, if you've read the Gospel at all to this point, who's going to win? Who always wins? Anything Peter can do, the beloved disciple can do better, faster, higher. It's just hard to be Peter in this Gospel. So sure enough, the beloved disciple gets to the tomb, and then we read this, and I'm going to read from verse 6. Well, we can read from verse 4. They both ran, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Okay. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying and the napkin, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a place by itself. So John is taking great pains to set the scene so that we can see it too as much as possible. Then the other disciple, who reached the tomb first, in case you had forgotten, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise from the dead. That is a really puzzling verse. What did he see and what did he believe? Now, one of the things that's often said that he believed is, remember, Mary has come and told them that she saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb, and she told them, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So some people think all it means is, well, he believed what Mary told him. And I think that's a really strange thing for a number of reasons. He doesn't have to go in twice to see that. And John's absolute use of the term believe never refers to anything mundane. It refers to having faith in Christ, believing. So I think it gets closer to meaning, and the beloved disciple believed maybe the words that Jesus had said earlier, I will live, you will live also, but he believes that Jesus is living. Peter doesn't get it, but the beloved disciple does. Later, they will have the scriptures and so on that help them to understand all this, but the beloved disciple believes and before and without any other, he's the only one in all the gospels to believe without a resurrection appearance of Jesus. Now that's kind of interesting, right? Nobody else does. But you see, that's exactly like the situation of the readers of the gospel. We don't have the kind of resurrection appearance that all the other disciples will get. Remember, Thomas says, well, unless I get one, I'm not going to believe either. And he gets one, right? Jesus appears to him. But nobody else believes without having seen Jesus, except the beloved disciple. And so he becomes both an example of those of us who believe without seeing and a witness to the fact that Jesus is living, even though he has never seen in the flesh the living Jesus. I'll come back to that. So I think one of the important things that John is trying to do is to establish the beloved disciple as a model, but not as a model who's somehow, you know, a preeminent leader or pastor or anything, just a model disciple. Model in the sense that he models the way that others will have to come to believe for every generation, either after Jesus or for all those who live in places where they never got to see Jesus in the flesh. So I think that's a kind of odd little story, but it fits with, as I hope you will see, with some of the other stories that Jesus has here. Then comes one of the best stories in all the Gospels when Jesus appears at the tomb to Mary Magdalene. And she is standing there, as you may remember, weeping. And she says, he says to her, woman, why are you weeping? And she repeats, because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him. I am told that's the way many students feel about seminary, but I can't quite tell you. No, that can't be true. Anyway, he's gone. Now, why does she want him back? She wants the body so she can apparently rebury it. You know, tell me where it is and I'll go get it. She has no idea he's alive, right? Notice then, at this point, she's weeping. He's standing right in front of her, but she doesn't know it is Jesus. Until what? He simply says her name, Mary. Now, I think there are two or three important things here for me. This is actually true of the gospel in this way. Jesus is virtually never recognized until he reveals himself. People are guessing, oh, you must be so-and-so, or could you be this, or maybe you're that. But he has to say, I'm the one. Or they'll say, we'd really like to have that bread that feeds us always. And he'll say, I am the bread of life. I could give you water that will never make you thirsty. And he has to always identify who he is and what he brings and what he does. Why? Because on their own, people will not recognize him. Think, for example, of the statement in the beginning of the gospel, the word became flesh and dwelt among us and we saw his glory. What does that mean? How many people saw Jesus? I don't know, you know, but hundreds, thousands. How many saw his glory? It is one thing to see Jesus, and it is another thing to see who he is. And I sometimes distinguish this in the gospel between sight and insight. So that eyewitness, being an eyewitness of Jesus on its own, may or may not get you anything. Lots of people saw Jesus do things, but it didn't necessarily lead them to have faith or to say, you are the Messiah, you are the Son of God. So that this is a even now, after his resurrection, he must still, and he still does, is the point, reveal himself, make himself known. So this is in many ways a recognition scene in that she knows who he is. She just doesn't recognize him. That's what Scott was talking about this morning. The difficulty of recognizing Jesus for who he is, even when he's standing in front of us. But the good news in John is that Jesus does reveal himself. Now, how does he do it? Well, one simple word. He speaks her name. This is, of course, an echo of what we had in John 10, when Jesus had identified himself as the Good Shepherd. And then he says, I am the good shepherd. I know my own know me. I have other sheep. I will bring them. They will heed my voice. And then when he also says in verse 4, the sheep follow the good shepherd, for they know his voice. And he calls them by name and leads them out. So that's how Jesus described what he was doing in the gospel. Notice that after the resurrection, he's still doing it. He still calls his own sheep by name. So that on the one hand, it has the function, I think, to reestablish his relationship with Mary, to identify that he is living. He's not in that tomb. Even if she found his body, please don't bury it because he's not dead. So this is all something that establishes Jesus is living, and it restores that personal relationship with Mary. But see, it's after the resurrection. So it's also something that Jesus says to you and you and me. He speaks our names. The living Lord still speaks and calls us by name. So I think this story also goes some way to establishing the new reality that characterizes Jesus and Mary's relationship with him. And I want to talk about one of the most puzzling verses in John, and I will solve all the problems about it now in about 3 seconds. She turned to him and said in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher, Jesus said to her, do not hold on to me, do not cling to me, do not touch me, for I have not yet ascended, gone up to the Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, etc. It's puzzling on any of a number of counts. She can't touch him because he's ascending. When he has ascended, will she be able to touch him? That doesn't make much sense. So just exactly what he's saying and what it means have puzzled people. But I tend to look at it like this. Look at the two commands he gave her. Do not hold, go and say. Do not cling, go and say. If you had been Mary and Jesus were dead, and suddenly he was alive in front of you, what would you want to do? What would you think? It's going to be the way it was before. He's back. It's going to be like it was. And Jesus is saying, no, it's not. I am not back the way I was. In fact, I am on my way to the Father, and you can't stay here because I can't stay here. So I'm going to the Father, and what do you do while I'm going to the Father? You go and bear witness to the resurrection. You go and tell them, he's alive. We have seen the Lord. So there are other ways, obviously, to read that, but I think if rather than worrying too much about what it means, do not hold, but look at the two contrasting commands, don't hold, don't grasp, don't cling, but go, it gives us some help. This is also the first time in many ways that Jesus explicitly identifies himself with his disciples, so that in the gospel, he often speaks of God as the Father or the Father who sent me, but never of God as our Father. But this is the first time he calls the disciples brothers and sisters, and says that it's this creation of a family that is new here. And then the final thing I want to comment on, notice how Mary goes and tells the disciples, I have seen the Lord, which is different than many of the other gospels in which the resurrection confession is what? He is risen. He is risen and he has appeared to Simon. Now this implies that, but notice it's not that just the announcement, he is risen, but I have seen him. And so this does two things, I think. One, it does tie us to the rest of the gospel. We have seen his glory. I saw him still. But it also restores that personal relationship. I saw him. He's living. That Jesus. It's in many ways a more personal kind of statement, it strikes me, while at the same time establishing that Jesus is living. So you have this story of Jesus and Mary, in which you have the recognition both of the fact that there is continuity with what was before, but in many ways, everything has changed and is changing. So that Mary now will represent the new reality that post-resurrection disciples have to live in. Knowing that he calls her name, he is alive, and she is called to bear witness to what she has seen. Then you have the story that Jesus appears to his disciples and gives them the Holy Spirit, and does that, as you may remember, by breathing on them. Notice it now says they saw the Lord and they rejoiced. So they've had the same now encounter that Mary did. He comes and stands among them, verse 19, and says, peace be with you. He showed them his hands and side. They were glad when they saw the Lord. He said to them, peace be with you. And he breathes the Holy Spirit on them. So I have written there, disciples are sent as Jesus was, both in terms of identity and mission. And that's because I'm a little Weasley on this particular verse. On the one hand, it strikes me how much it is like the book of Genesis. He breathes and they receive the Spirit. They become living. Remember, it says, God breathed into Adam and he became a nefesh haya, a living being. Well, now he breathes into them and it's as if they are given that new life that Jesus gives. On the other hand, notice it's linked to sending. Receive the Holy Spirit, I am sending you. So that it's people sometimes debate. Is this a passage about new creation, new life, or is this a passage about mission? And I wonder if we shouldn't, in fact, link those two much more closely together. They are in mission because of who they are, the new life-given people of God, and the new people of the people of God who have been given life by the Spirit are simply in mission. They don't have to go and do mission. They simply are in mission and need to sort of wake up to that fact, as it were. So Jesus was the Son of the Father who was life. Is that his identity or is that his mission? He is life, so he gives life. He gives life because he is life. They're inseparable statements about who Jesus is. So I suppose I want to have it both ways, but because of the fact that the Spirit is both in John, the life-giving Spirit, and the Spirit who sends people, that John doesn't say, well, sometimes you get life, and sometimes it's one Spirit who has this recreating and sending work. Then we get Thomas. I think Thomas gets a bum rap in this gospel, so I have come to rehabilitate Thomas for you. So, 8 days later, oh no, here we go, verse 24. Thomas, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. Is this like nanny, nanny, you know, it's just, we have seen him. And Thomas says, well, I haven't. So unless I see in his hands the print of the nails and place my finger in the mark of the nails and place my hand in his side, I will not believe. Now notice, Thomas is not asking for anything other than what they had. He's not asking for more or extra. He's simply saying, you saw, I want to see. You saw and believed. You didn't believe before you saw. Well, except for that beloved disciple, but we'll leave him out of the picture. None of you believed before you saw. Why do I have to believe that way? So I think his question is entirely legitimate. I want to see. Don't we all? I mean, I want to see Jesus. I don't know about the rest of heaven and pearly gates and all that kind of stuff, but I'm pretty sure I want to. I have a lot of questions I want to ask him, among other things, but I want to see Jesus. In chapter 12, remember when the Greeks come and you have that famous line, they say, we want to see Jesus. People want to see Jesus. It's no different if he's with them or if he's risen. So they say, we have seen the Lord. And notice that Thomas refuses to trust their testimony. This is a word to disciples, I think. Jesus says, you know what? They're not going to treat you any better than they treated me. They didn't believe me. Why do you think they're going to believe you? But the call is still to bear witness to the risen Lord. Thomas refuses to trust their testimony. So Jesus comes again. 8 days later, his disciples were in the house, and Thomas was with them. The doors were shut. Jesus stood among them and said, peace be with you. And then Jesus says, okay, put your finger here. See my hands. Put out your hands. Now, my RSV, which is the old inspired version. you know, when you grow up, memorize something, and then they come along and mess it all up with the NRSV. It's just very distressing. So at any rate. Besides, it more often proves my point. So, but the RSV translates it this way. Do not be faithless, but believing. So what is Thomas invited to do? He's not invited to stop doubting so much as he is to put his faith in the risen Lord, just the way everybody else who has seen him up to this point has. And notice then when Thomas sees him, what he says. He gets the point. My Lord and my God. Now, I take that in part it's hard to know exactly all the nuances of that. In Psalm 34, 23, you have, I think it's my God and my Lord, the prayer that is there. Some of you may know that this is very close to the language that was used at least of one Roman emperor who was called Master and God. And some people wonder where this is playing against that kind of language. So that there are other reasons in which for which this other resonances of this language. But one of the things that I think matters in this gospel is that God is the source of all life. God is the source of all power. And he has given this life and given this power, this authority, to the Son, we read in John 5. So that in some way, Jesus has what God has. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. He is both the Word with God and God. So it is appropriate for Thomas to acknowledge this living one, this one with power and authority as my Lord and my God. And that, of course, is really in many ways the high point of the gospel. We could quit. And in fact, we nearly do. Except that you read this. Jesus says, have you believed because you have seen me? Or you don't need to put that as a question. That could be a statement. You have believed because you have seen me. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. See that note that runs throughout these resurrection appearances? You see and believe. Good for you. That's the right response. But there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be called to believe simply because of the testimony of others. And it's going to be hard. Nevertheless, they too are going to be called to believe. And blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. And then you get the summary. So the first set of appearances, you've got this establishing that Jesus is alive. That is closely linked to the call to faith. And I think that's very much, notice it's there isn't a sense in John in which you try to prove the resurrection. You bear witness to it, which is a different thing. It's not an apologetic. What are the eight ways we could establish that Jesus is alive? This is the foundation on which the gospel is based. So the witness of disciples is not to get people to the proofs that will lead them to believe it, but to bear witness and then to call them to faith. That's the way the gospel, I think, reads. That the Lord to whom witness is born is the same Lord before and after the resurrection, with some major differences. And we can't underestimate those, but keep those things in mind a little bit as we turn to chapter 21. All right, so we're on the beach. And we've got Peter and his friends decide to go fishing. It really is interesting to look at the ways commentators try to explain why does Peter say, I'm going fishing. And the reason I think it's interesting, for some people, this is a dereliction of duty. They should have been out bearing witness. Jesus had said, I'm sending you. Why are they up there fishing? Other people get as mundane as saying, well, maybe Simon was hungry. He said, I'm going fishing. So, and you get all kinds of interpretations all between there. But at any rate, they go with him. And you know the story, that they aren't having any luck. And in the middle of the fishing trip, Jesus is standing on the beach in verse 4, and we read, the disciples did not know it was Jesus. See how that sounds like Mary Magdalene in front of the tomb? She's looking at him. He's there, but she doesn't know who it is. They don't know it's Jesus. Indeed, why should they? How far away are they from the shore? When was the last time they saw him? You know, there's a lot of reasons that you could explain this. But I think the main point to notice is they simply do not recognize him. So what does it take to recognize Jesus? An act in which he reveals himself and the witness of somebody else. So that he does something that is one of those Jesus things, right? Cast the net on the right side of the boat. And the minute they do, they get a large quantity of fish. And now notice, who is it who recognizes Jesus? The disciple whom Jesus loved. His role in this gospel is to bear witness to Jesus. And he's the one who says, it is the Lord. And now Simon believes it. He accepts that testimony and jumps into the water, swims to shore to see Jesus, and the others bring the fish. And then you have the story, bring the boat with all the large fish, 153 of them. And Jesus invites them to breakfast, and they're sitting there. And I love the way John says it, verse 12. None of them dared to ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord, but they didn't know as all that confidently, did they? They knew it was the Lord, says John. So why does he say they didn't dare to ask him, who are you? There is some, who is this guy? But the beloved disciple told us, and he revealed himself in a Jesus kind of way. So we accept that testimony. We believe that revelation because it's consonant. It goes along with what we have known as Jesus before. Now, what is it that Jesus does? He feeds them. He's done this before, and he continues to do it. He fed 5,000. He still feeds them. He promised them to be the bread of life. He is still sustaining them. So there is this continuity of what Jesus does before and after the resurrection that you see here in this in the paired stories, as it were, between John 20 and John 21. It's, of course, also interesting that they're standing there around a charcoal fire. There's one other time when a charcoal fire has been mentioned in John, and that's at the scene of Peter's denial, where it says, and they were standing around the charcoal fire warming themselves. So I suppose if you're Simon Peter and you see another charcoal fire, you say, uh-oh. And sure enough, here come three questions. This time, not from the maid and all the people around, but from Jesus himself. So that gets us to the next story, three questions for Simon Peter. When they had finished breakfast, verse 15, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? He said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. A second time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved, troubled, distressed, because he had pained, because he had said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. So there's Jesus' commissioning of Peter to the very work that Jesus himself does. Jesus is the shepherd who feeds the sheep, but now he's going to entrust that work to others in a way that he hasn't entrusted it to them before. Here comes one of the new things that you get in John 21. It's a big job for Peter, who hasn't exactly proved to be the most trustworthy of disciples up to this point. But it's as if Jesus says, Peter, you're all I've got. In other words, Jesus doesn't need perfect disciples. He just needs those who will do what he commands. And what is it that Jesus commands? When you were young, well, to tend and to feed his sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you girded yourself and walked where you would not, where you would, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands. Another will gird and carry you in a way you do not wish to go. And after this, he said to him, follow me. When was the first time Jesus said that? That was a long time ago in chapter 1 through the disciples. And see, it's at the end the way it was in the beginning, and Jesus always says the same thing to his disciples. At the end of it all, at the bottom of it all, what counts is following Jesus. Whether he's the one who's living in Galilee or whether he's the risen Lord, he still calls people, follow me. And so although we often think of the great difference there is between Jesus in Nazareth and Jesus today, we don't see him, we can't touch him, we can't eat with him. I think John is one of the things John is trying very hard to do. And let me just go into my summary points here, and then we can stop and go back over any of these appearances you want. To establish that Jesus is alive and present, but that there are no second-class disciples. You aren't a lesser disciple because you weren't among the 12. You aren't a lesser disciple because you didn't see him, you weren't with him. How do I know that? Because the kinds of questions Jesus asks us, the call he gives to us, is exactly what he gave to them. He still calls disciples, follow me, asks, do you love me, and in charges the care of the flock to them. So no second class disciples. I think John, of all the gospels, tries to show the ways in which the layers that here's Jesus in his first century context, and here we are in whatever century, in whatever world, and there are big differences. But being a disciple of Jesus fundamentally is the same kind of thing. And then you read the gospel to find out what is that? What does that involve? And the gospel lays that out. Notice also the importance of the witness of others. In his own time and day, Jesus depended on others to bear witness to him. And that goes back even to chapter 1. You remember the stories? He calls Andrew. Andrew goes and gets his brother. He's going to go to Galilee, and Philip goes and finds someone else. Someone is always finding someone else, bearing witness. That happens in the resurrection appearances in chapter 20. And it's the commission that is going to be given to the disciples and to Peter and to the beloved disciple here in chapter 21. So that in 21, it's not a resurrection appearance. But remember, after Jesus says, "Follow me," Peter says, "Yeah, well, what about this guy? What's going to happen to him?" And Jesus sort of says, "None of your business. You just follow me." And then this other guy turns out to be the one who is bearing witness to these things and has written them. He's carrying out the task to bear witness. In many ways, Peter will be given the charge to pastor. So different tasks, different roles for different disciples, all under the umbrella, follow me. Also, seeing and believing. And again, the two words I like to play with are sight and insight. It's very interesting in John the way some people see but don't see, and the way people who don't see, see, right? He likes to play with that imagery. So there are all kinds of people who see Jesus, but they have no insight into who he is. And then, of course, the healing of the blind man in chapter 9 is the paradigmatic story of someone without physical sight gains physical sight, but also gains the sight to see who Jesus is and confesses him at the end of that story as Lord, Son of Man, and worships him. By the same token, at the end of chapter 9, the Pharisees, who don't see who Jesus is, even though they see him, say, "You mean we're blind?" "Yes," said John, "you don't see. You don't understand. You don't perceive. You don't get it." So that sight and insight are images that John likes to play with. And he's not alone in the ancient world in playing with these themes in terms of seeing and understanding and using the image of sight to do so. The basic stance, it strikes me, that disciples then and now are called to is the stance of trust or faith. That doesn't change whether it's the first century or the 21st century. It all comes down eventually to following me. So those are some of my quick thoughts on the resurrection appearances in John. So they have a slightly different orientation, although they both pull together some similar themes, and both of them in different ways connect what you see in the risen Lord to who he is in the stories in the gospel itself. So that if I can pull this up, there's a famous quote from Hoskins, who wrote a commentary on the Gospel of John. How does it go? It's something to this effect, that what John is trying to establish is the point that who he is who he was in the flesh. See, the who he is who he was, and that John gets the difference. There's a before and an after, but likes to talk about the continuity of that person, so that you don't get someone new after the resurrection. He simply is who he always was. So I wonder what questions or comments or thoughts you have on the resurrection appearances in John, and more, maybe perhaps more specifically about what you have found helpful yourselves in preaching about John's distinctive stories, because they are different. Yeah.
One thing that, excuse me, always strikes me about the Peter story in 21 is they're in Galilee.
Right.
Before they were in Jerusalem.
Right.
So why did they leave?
Yeah.
And then why does it matter that there are 153 fish?
Oh, I got an answer for that one. Remember in the Gospel of Mark at the end, Jesus says, "Go to Galilee, he will see you there." And so there are no resurrection appearances. Well, in Mark, there aren't any at all, right? But they're not going to be any in Jerusalem. You'll see him in Galilee.
Yeah.
So we've got some stories in Jerusalem and some in Galilee. And John does not say what they're doing in Galilee, why they went home, but they did. And you could probably do something interesting with the geography. They saw him in Jerusalem, but wherever they are, they can't get away from him. They saw them there. Why 153? Because fishermen count fish. You know, I can't tell you how many interesting hypotheses have been ventured on this. Augustine had one, you know, I'm trying to remember how this works. If you add up all the numbers between 1 and 17, you get 153. But why does 17 matter? Well, because 10 stood for the Ten Commandments and 7 stood for something else. So, but if you draw this as a triangle, you know, and if you do this right and you get all the dots, then you get a perfect triangle with 17 dots. And so this was really, in ancient commentaries, you can find a lot of speculation on this. There's also been some interesting stuff done on gematria, where you take the letters of the Hebrew alphabet or the Greek alphabet and you assign numerical value to them. So alpha is 1, or in Hebrew, aleph is 1. I actually have a Hebrew Bible where the chapters are numbered not with Arabic numbers, but with Hebrew letters, which is why I can't use it, because, you know, what is Aleph again? Okay, this is what you get in the book of Revelation, right? 666 stands for something, and people try and figure out what 666 is. So here's why this is important. If you add up, this is in the book of Ezekiel, I think, if you add up the numbers in En Gedi and Eglayim, which in one of the verses in Ezekiel says, and they will stand at the great sea fishing and catch all the fish of the sea and bring them in, you actually get 153. Wow. So maybe it's a really cryptic reference, not to anything specific, but to a way of referring to Ezekiel's statement that there's an abundance of fish. It's the abundance theme, which John does like. You know, how many baskets were left over? 12. How many jars of wine? Well, a lot more than anybody needed. And he likes to stress the abundance. So maybe that's a possibility. There is an option that one of the, I think it's Jerome, says it stands for all the kind of fish in the world. The problem with that is the only evidence that 153 is the number for all the fish in the world is Jerome himself. You know, in other words, it's not Jerome, it's somebody else. But the point is there is no independent attestation of it. So it looks like he made it up. It's good. It gets at what John would be about. It's just very hard to know why does he mention it? So like I said, maybe they just counted at the end of the day. Because notice, they were big fish. You know, they weren't little dinky ones. They were big. Yeah.
I'm struck by the contrast between John 1's call to follow Jesus,
yeah,
which is a very, probably a geographic,
yeah,
call, right?
Yeah, kind right, right, yes.
And he ends with,
yeah, and how are you going to do that?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And I think, yeah, that's really good, because that's one of the things that shows it's exactly the same words and it can't be exactly the same thing. We have seen him, we still see him, but it can't mean the same thing. So that's in many ways what the gospel story is about. If you love me, keep my commandments, you know, etc., so that you get the content of following by reading it. But thank you. That's a great way to frame that as well. Phil?
Do you think anything should be made of the contrast between agape and philia?
No, I don't. You want my lecture on why not?
Yeah, no,
okay.
I'm just being interested in why.
Yeah, what Phil is referring to is when Jesus asks Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He asks with the verb agapao, agape love. And Peter answers, how about some phileo? You know, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Number two, agape, that kind of love. And Peter can't quite get there. The third time, Jesus changes it and says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And uses phileo. And then Peter says, yeah, I can do that. So the way that's often interpreted is Jesus asks twice, you know, how much do you love me? With what kind of depth? With what kind of love? And Peter can't get to where he is. And then depending on how you read it, Jesus condescends. Jesus is generous. Jesus is merciful and said, okay, how about this? And Peter says, yeah, I can do that. The reason I don't think that works is that I don't think John actually uses the verbs that way in the rest of the gospel. That when he talks about the Father loves the Son, he will use both verbs. So that could mean God has both kinds of love for the Son. He's got this sort of divine love and this fraternal love. But John does not distinguish elsewhere those verbs in a way that we can see very distinctly. This goes here and this goes here. This is what God does. This is what human beings do. So that's the first reason I think that's unlikely.
So they may just be synonymous.
I think they're synonymous. John likes synonyms. He has two words for knowing, you know, two words for sending, the Father who sent me. And you can't tell that they're different. In older literature, they made a huge thing about all the differences. This kind of knowing, that kind of knowing. This kind of sending, that kind of sending. And the other thing to say is, Notice Jesus doesn't really change what he tells Simon based on Simon's answer. So he doesn't say, okay, well, if you can't love me like that, then maybe you can just feed some lambs. You know, it's not like he says, all right, then I'll give you a little bit to do. And he doesn't change what he tells Simon. He seems almost to ignore it. Just says, feed 10 feet, you know. So I can't tell from the structure of the story that it mattered what Simon said. The third time does matter. And for some people, the third is linked to, he switches the word. And to some, three, we've been there before. Just like at the denial three times, now it's three times. And so it's hitting home a little bit, because three times he was asked, do you know who, will you confess Jesus? And he said, no. So now, do you really love me? So that's the way I tend to read it, yeah. Yes?
I wanted to come back to your comments on Thomas.
Yeah.
And sort of calibrating our criticism of Thomas to the right level. Where some, you know, kind of, I think you kind of said you over-criticize him for his doubts. And then there's others who almost make him into a kind of hero of doubt, good for him.
Yeah, right, right.
So the phrase that I picked up that seemed to be weighty was at the end of the verse, at end of 25, when he says, who may his do so, that it's got a, I think the phrase was an emphatic future negation.
I will never believe.
I will refuse to believe. And so whether that tips the hand to him being, not only I'd like to believe your testimony, but I'm struggling, but to a, I absolutely refuse to believe unless I get firsthand physical. Is there anything to that?
I think it's just the others saw and believed. He didn't see, so he didn't believe. I think it's very difficult to get to the internal state of Thomas at this point. I guess, you know, he's always called Doubting Thomas, and Doubting Thomas is okay as long as we realize that, well, here's the problem with it. You could be believing the way Jesus calls Peter and Simon and all the other disciples to believe and still have doubts. That's a different thing. And so I think believing in John is a fundamental stance of faith or trust that is turned towards Jesus. And that's what Thomas right now, he's not in danger of being a doubter. He's in danger of being, for lack of a better term, an unbeliever. You know, but he's still one of the 12. He's still called the twin. He's still there. He's still one of the disciples. But Peter, Jesus says, I invite you to have faith. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I've read some commentaries that will make the link between, you've made a distinction between believing and seeing and believing based on testimony.
Yeah.
That part of Thomas's problem was a mistrust of the testimony.
Right. He doesn't believe the testimony that's given to him. And how does it help that if he didn't believe the testimony, he's a doubter?
I don't know.
It is often said it's not so much that he doesn't believe because his problem is that he doesn't believe the apostolic witness, to put it that way. In other words, he becomes a model for laters who are going to have to believe the apostolic witness, right? But I'm not sure that changes the understanding of whether he's a doubter or not. I just think it's interesting to look at the Greek and you say, oh, that's interesting. They don't have the word doubt. They have the word unbelief. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's the contrast there for John. And there aren't very many English translations that get it. And the RSV gets close, but it chose different words, faithless and believing. So you don't see it in English as easily as you do. Yeah.
The English Standard Version has it that way.
What does the English Standard Version have?
It says, let's see, what verse is that again?
It's 27 at the very end. Probably there's just
when you were saying it, I read it. It's gosh, I should. The English Standard Version says,
"Do not disbelieve but believe."
Do not disbelieve but believe. Yeah, they turn that, and they just turn the adjectives into verbs there to try and get the. Parallelism. We have trouble in English because we have the word believe, but we don't have we don't have a good, we have faithful or have faith, we have belief, but belief and faith are really two different things for us. So we don't have verbs and adjectives that correspond exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, two questions. First, regarding the unrecognized.
Yeah.
Scenes,
yeah.
Just wondering if you were, say, advising like a playwright or a director who is trying to present this that way, like visually.
Yeah.
Just wondering how you might suggest showing that Jesus, I don't know, like a fake mustache or something.
How Jesus isn't recognized?
Yeah. And then the other question I had was, how might you advise them on how to present that, perhaps? And then the other question is regarding Jesus calling his disciples my brothers.
Yeah.
Post-resurrection. I'm just wondering, especially in terms of preaching.
Yeah.
Like, why hasn't Jesus called them his brothers before that? For example, in contrast to Mark.
Yeah, exactly. These are my brothers and my sisters. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the first one, it's interesting because it's saying you wanted to make a movie of this. The problem really isn't that it's Jesus in disguise. So if it were, this is how it's usually done. He's got a hoodie or a cloak or something, and so you can't actually see his face, but that's not the problem. The problem is not Jesus. The problem is we don't see him. So you would have to do it, like you'd have a bunch of people staring right at him, but they don't actually see. I'm not sure.
Give them a pair of glasses.
Yeah, yeah. It's something in them. And so it always is interesting to ask, how would you film this? Or how would you make this come alive visually? But there the problem doesn't lie in Jesus, but that's what we usually go for. Because then he can strip off his disguise or something and be revealed. So it gets at the point that he has to do something to reveal himself, but it makes it look like he was sneaking around. He didn't want to be recognized or something. And it's not clear to me that that's the point. Remind me, your second question. Oh, the brothers and sisters. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. It goes along with, so how many times do you think in the Gospel of Mark, God is called Father, or God is called the Father of Jesus, or God is called Father? Mark. Just someone guess. It's like four, I think. How many times in the Gospel of John? It's like over 120.
Yeah.
So something has happened in the, and it's almost always, except for one or like here in John 20, the Father who sent me, the Father, my Father, not our Father. So that it's very important that in John, you understand the relationship first between Jesus and the Father, that who he is the Son of the Father. So there may just be a difference in emphasis at that point, a different way of telling the story. Remember at the cross, though, at the foot of the cross, Jesus entrusts the care of his mother to this disciple whom Jesus loved, and this is your mother, this is your son. That's like a family there, the beginning of it. That's close to the stories in the synoptics. What do you mean, here's my mother and my father, my brothers are anyone who do my will. So there are themes that this is coming, but it's somehow linked particularly to what happens in his death and resurrection. Very much like Paul, who says it is by the Spirit that we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit creates this community, this post-resurrection community of Jews and Gentiles together. Is that what John is up? But it is an interesting difference, yeah.
Yeah. Is it at all perhaps related to what we get in the prologue when it says that those who, all who do receive him,
become children of God?
Become children of God.
Yeah, there's the foreshadowing, but it's notice, children of God, and it doesn't yet say, and therefore my brothers and sisters. Hebrews makes a big deal of this. Right. We are his brothers, he's the older brother, the son. It's wonderful the way it does that. And John is, I think, just emphasizing something else, going in a slightly different direction there. Yeah. Yeah. John should have come with footnotes, in my opinion. See Hebrews. I mean this, I just don't have time to explain it. This is like that theme.
Yes, but it strikes me that when you write there are no second class disciples,
yeah,
among the first people that Jesus calls is Nathaniel, but mm-hmm. I don't think he's ever listed in, because actually...
He's in 21, yeah.
But he's not listed among in the class lists of disciples.
Remember, John does not list the disciples ever. He's very puzzling at that point. So that John gives, at one point he just says there were the 12, but he never has a scene where Jesus chose them, and he never lists them out. So it's actually very difficult in John to figure out, is there another 12? And then there's this Nathaniel guy, or how do these things overlap? Yeah.
He's not in the class of the others, so you have to be careful with synoptics.
So what you have to do then is to say, Nathaniel, whose other name is Bartholomew, and Philip, whose other name, you know. So people do that a lot to try and bring those together. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that have to do with perhaps the author assuming a certain amount of pre-knowledge on the part of the hearers, or is there any theorizing around that?
Oh, yes.
I should have asked. The
names of those books and article are legion, who have tried to figure out what does John assume that his readers know? And that gets you into all the questions of John and the synoptics and so on. I think it is really hard to answer the question, what does John assume his readers know? Which readers? People who've never read the gospel? People who are first-time believers? You know, which readers should know this? And the second question is, how should they know it? If you ask, what does the gospel itself tell us? It seems to imply that among the disciples, Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee, who are never named in this gospel except as the sons of Zebedee, and two others. Well, who are they? You know? So he's got this maddening habit of assuming we know things, and you want to say, well, how are we supposed to know them? This is where he needs footnotes. So I think it's a little bit of style, and I don't know if it's just kind of John's trying to pique our curiosity or whether he just doesn't think to tell us. It's very hard to know the answer to that question. Yeah.
Prefer to emphasize something else.
Prefer to emphasize something else, but why not tell us who the two other disciples were? Did he just like, I don't know their names. They were some other guys, whoever they were. Those other dudes.
What's his name?
What's his name? What was his name?
I mean, I was his favorite. But...
Yeah, that's right. There was one question back here.
If you were to recommend a commentary, which is one of your favorites?
Well, there's an excellent one that Westminster John Knox did that I wrote. I'm kind of fond of that. Now and then I reread it and say, yeah, Thompson. I reread it and say, wow, how did I miss that altogether? But, you know, have you ever preached something and the next Sunday you go back or the next time you preach it, you say, oh my goodness, why did I say that and why didn't I say this? What did I rely on a lot? That is a really good question that I'm having trouble with at the moment. You know, I like some offbeat kinds of things. There's a little commentary by Joanne Brandt that's published by, what's the publisher, is that Baker? Baker? I think that one's very intriguing for the differences it has from some of the traditional readings. Gail O'Day's commentary in the New Interpreter's Bible is pretty good, I think. I like Andrew Lincoln's commentary a lot in the, I don't want to say word, but it's not word. Hendrickson, the Black's commentary series.